So tonight I'd like to read and comment on a piece from Zen Master Dogen, primarily. If we have time, a few poems by Uchiyama Roshi. One of the most influential and wonderful pieces that Dogen ever wrote is called The Genjo Koan. And this is a piece from The Genjo Koan. And the reason I'm reading this and commenting on it tonight is that it speaks to, in a very practical way, something that is really necessary if we wish to really get onto the true wavelength of Zazen. Zazen is really not involved in the discursive mind's activities. It's not something that has a philosophy, nor is it something to be understood. But it is the awakening of a way of knowing, and thereby a way of being in the world that is not accessible through the discursive mind. The reason it's not accessible through the discursive mind is that the discursive mind is a divided state. There is that which is being discussed, and there is the one who is discussing it. There is the gain and loss of knowledge, and there is a hierarchy and a spectrum of this kind of gain and loss. And so it is with all the dualities that are the primary characteristic and, from a Zen viewpoint, the affliction of a human being. The way of Zazen is to not denigrate that kind of thinking, not to try to cast it away or to battle with it or anything of that sort, but to realize that it is a limited faculty for all the power that everyone who uses it has realized. It is nonetheless a limiting faculty because it is fundamentally based upon duality and separation. Zazen, the practice of Zen generally, is about coming into a unitive state. Now, we can't strategize that. The immediate response of this discursive mind is to imagine what a unitive state would be and to create some kind of a strategy to arrive at that. But again, this is based upon duality and will never lead to the place that we're talking about. The reason for that is the presupposition underneath that is that whatever it is, a unified state or state of enlightenment or the Buddha mind, whatever it is something that you don't have. Therefore, you have to strive for it. You have to consult, you have to create a strategy for it. And that's the presupposition, which is the reason that such activity will never lead to it. So you are required to, if you're really serious about the practice of Zen, and are bolstered in your practice by a, not a belief, but a faith that such a thing really exists, that there's this not, Zen masters were not either stupid or crazy, that there is a something. And we say those, we use those words loosely, because words are fundamentally based upon duality. There are no words that refer to non-duality. So we use the words that came into existence with the discursive mind and with the presuppositions of this and that, and that the world is really broken up realistically into parts and so on, rather than that this is a convenient structuring of our experience by the mind. And so we use these words very differently from how they would be used with the discursive mind. Discursive mind is concerned with the precision of definitions and the non-ambiguous use of words and so on. In this work, when we use the words, we are using them as pointers, not as delineators, not as graspers, not as a cage, not as a boundary within which boundary the thing we're speaking of exists, and outside of that boundary it does not exist. We are not using them in that way. We're using them as pointers. Now, these pointers can be useful only if one has already got some sense of a way of utilizing these pointers. That is to say that one might have some kind of what I've come to call spiritual intelligence. Spiritual intelligence is not a matter of knowing content. It doesn't matter at all how much comparative religion you've studied or anything like that, how many of the sutras you've read or anything of that sort. But it is a way of discerning what is being pointed to. Sometimes we speak of it as seeing with the third eye or hearing with the third ear. Again, this is not to be considered as anything flaky or anything in connection with how one might also have heard of the use of the third eye and so on. But to use these words as pointers, this is used a lot in some of the best poetry. It certainly is used a lot more in Japanese haiku, for example. The famous haiku about the frog, the old pond, the frog jumps in, plop. A discursive mind picks that up and says, well, big deal, you know, and this old frog jumps in the pond, and that's the sound of the frog. You've not discerned what's being pointed to. Something is being pointed to. And that is not to be accessed through the discursive mind. Well, let me see now. What would be the meaning of the pond or the frog? No, it's not to be accessed in that way. This is going, as we say in Zen, south to find the North Star. So it's a matter of how do we access that mode? How do we come to the threshold of accessing that other way of knowing, which is not only the secret of the practice of Zen, including the koan and so on, but it is the secret of life itself. It is the secret of a vibrant, participative life that is, in Buddhist terminology, beyond suffering, beyond all the presuppositions of suffering. I did not say it was beyond pain, but it is beyond suffering. That which we do to pain, that which we do to unsatisfactoriness, building a story around it and so on, that create suffering. So, how to access this? Zen Master Dogen says, from the Genja Koan, he says, firewood becomes ash. Ash cannot become firewood again. However, we should not view ash as after and firewood as before. We should know that firewood dwells in the Dharma position of firewood and has its own before and after. Although before and after exist, past and future are cut off. Ash stays in the position of ash with its own before and after. As firewood never becomes firewood again after it is burnt to ash, there is no return to living after a person dies. However, in Buddha Dharma, it is an unchanged tradition not to say that life becomes death. Therefore, we call it no arising. It is the established way of Buddhas turning the Dharma wheel not to say that death becomes life. Therefore, we call it no perishing. Life is a position in time. Death is also a position in time. This is like winter and spring. We don't think that winter becomes spring, and we don't say that spring becomes summer. Now, there are two things involved here, and these two things are really essential to our whole participative understanding of our life. One is, things are organized in a temporal sequence. Firewood, when burnt, becomes ash. Tadpoles, as they develop, become frogs. This is not untrue. But it is not a place of life. It's a place of interest, fascination, curiosity, acquisition of knowledge that might be useful in predicting various things or utilizing the knowledge in a scientific way or whatever. But it is not life. We do not live when our moments of the highest living are experienced and are revisited and examined. We do not live from this dualistic place. In that non-dualistic place where our life resides, firewood is firewood, and ash is ash. A tadpole is fully and completely a tadpole. It is not in a sequence that goes towards frogs. It is fully itself as a tadpole. We human beings, if we do the analogy of tadpoles, would be thinking, well, I'm a tadpole now, but eventually my hind legs will start to sprout. That's the whole point, so I'm looking forward to that. It's like going from kindergarten to elementary school, and then, of course, my tail gets to be resorbed. I'm looking forward to that, too. I'll be bigger. And eventually my front legs will start to sprout, and I'll become a four-legged being with a tail that's receding, and as I get to go to graduate school, I'll become a frog. And I can jump up on land, and I don't have to be restricted to the aquatic environment anymore, and I can live in both places. And I can eat algae in the water, and I can eat flies on land, and it's going to be really something. I'm looking forward to this development. That's how we human beings think. And it's not wrong to think that way. It's very useful to think that way. Once I have my degree, then I'll be able to do this, and then I'll be able to do that, and so on. It is, however, a dream. There's no certainty in it. The tadpole could get eaten by a fish before it gets to become a frog, and a frog could get eaten by a snake and by a bird and so on, and so it wouldn't have the kind of idyllic frog life that it wanted and so on. So it's a mode of orienting this temporal sequence is a mode of orienting our life in a certain direction. But if we compare ourselves at all times to the goal that we are aiming for as a statement of the validity of our life, I haven't quite mastered that. I just have a lot more work to do. I haven't grasped that yet. Then we fail to realize that at each moment we are full and complete, as we are. As we are full and complete. Now that realization of our fullness and completeness and our operating from that place of fullness and completeness does not prevent us from orienting our direction of movement in the karmic world towards some particular goal. However, it confers the possibility of a vibrancy of life along the way, and not a postponement of our life until the time when we have acquired or gained whatever it is that we think we ought to gain to make our life more complete or full or happy or whatever the terminology might be at the time. So the way of accessing this place of fullness and completeness is a way of finally accessing Buddha nature. It is not something to be acquired. It is something that already exists. And here is the paradox. As we go through this door of the practice of Zen, we go into a world that I have sometimes called the upside-down kingdom. If you want it and you grasp for it, you don't get it. And so on. We could give many illustrations. The reason is you're setting it up presuppositionally to make it a dualistic endeavor. So the question is then, how do you make this endeavor of Zazen a non-dualistic activity? Not within the boundaries of this and that. Not within the boundaries of gain and loss. Not within the boundaries of good and bad or achievement or failure. How do you do that? Well, there's a couple of ways that we offer to people in the practice of Zen. And one of them is to realize that all these thoughts that come into the mind, all these feelings, all these memories, all these projections into the future, hopes and fears and all the rest of it, have no substance worth looking at. When you are practicing zazen, I am not saying that it is unimportant to design an appropriate retirement strategy or to save your money or to build up equity in a house and whatever else you might be involved in, or to acquire a degree or whatever it might be that is a part of your karmic position in the world. But I'm saying for the practice of zazen, which is learning how to access this non-dualistic mode of operating in the world, and thereby the vibrancy and depth of life that is possible living from that place, it is necessary to do something quite different. Now, a kind of image that we use is that the aware consciousness busies itself so much that it obstructs its vision. It busies itself with picking up all the contents that come through the mind. And when one lets go, when one understands what I just said about the use of the mind, and that there's an appropriate use of the mind, if it says, okay, well, I'm not using the mind now for pursuing a particular goal, so now what do I do? Well, then in come random thoughts. A response to stimuli in the environment. A car passes in the street, a bird sounds, someone talks to you, whatever it may be, there's a response to the stimuli that the environment presents, and likewise, many of these things arise spontaneously from within. And spontaneously, I mean they are uninvited. You didn't ask to have these thoughts come in, but lo and behold, in they come. Now, it's a matter of how do you deal with those things, the uninvited, gratuitously arriving thoughts, memories, fantasies, emotions, and so on. How do you deal with them? In order that they not be obstructions in the mind. By an obstruction in the mind, I mean that they don't cling there. Because that very clinging produces an obstruction in the mind. So what we are concerned with is allowing to develop what we could call a pure mind. A mind where there is nothing but... Now what are we going to say? Nothing but a something with a name that we can aim for and develop a strategy in order to acquire? No, so we use words as pointers. There'll be nothing but conscious awareness. Now conscious awareness is not a thing. But it's our attempt to point at some state of being that is not being involved with the adherence of all these random, we call them random, there is nothing random in the universe, but these uninvited thoughts and feelings and memories and fantasies and emotions and so on that come into this field of consciousness. There is nothing but that. And finally, there is what we call a pure mind. There is nothing there but one thing. What's the one thing? The one thing could be breathing. The one thing could be walking. This step, this step, this step. Not thoughts about it. Not an idea that they are leading to a somewhere that gives them their significance. There is the drinking of a cup of water. Just this. Not that it is to slake thirst. Not any idea of the physics and chemistry of water, the physiology of drinking it. Those are all fine. But they are not this unitive way of operating in the world, this experiential mode of operating in the world. Now, of course, as I say those words, you say, well, okay, I have an idea of what that is. I'll just aim for it and I'll do it. I'll try every time to kind of push the thoughts out of the way so I can have this just one with what I'm doing. And of course, that's a dualistic activity. So it can't be acquired that way. So we are not inventing new things to strategize for here. It's a very important point. We are pointing in a direction. Pointing in a certain direction. Not that you should use anything I say as a mode of evaluating your judgment of the state of mind that you're in at any given time. For this activity of judgment is in itself dualistic. There is a judger and there is that which is being judged and so on. One can ask very simply, who are the two people there? Not to mind to point out that nobody has found one person, not to mind two. So it's quite a different kind of endeavor. So we say, let the thoughts come and go. We give helpful hints, like saying, you all have a resident mind. And minds, it's their business. They generate generalizations, and they comment on things, and they make judgments, and they think some things are important, some things are unimportant. They do all these kinds of things. It's just the mind. It's just the mind. You have one of those resident guys, and it just does that stuff. And it enjoys the way in which it can do that. It likes being smart and delineating things very well. And so, well, that's fine. Not in this context, though. So you just notice it now as a kind of activity, a phenomenon of mind, rather than be involved in its content. So everything that comes into the mind, everything, I underline everything, without exception, that comes into the mind, be it exalted thoughts, Buddhism, whatever, enlightenment, be it base thoughts, be it mundane thoughts, as you might call them, or be it some other kind of thought, it doesn't matter. All those are just human designations, just inventions, just stories. They're nothing from this viewpoint. So you let them come and you let them go. You don't care if they come, you don't care if they go. You open all the gates and windows to your domain of conscious awareness, and if they want to come in, they come in. If they want to go out, they go out. If they want to stay, they stay. If they don't want to stay, they don't stay. And it doesn't matter to you. Instead of paying attention to all those things, you have what we call your practice. And that's just a temporary designation, and it could be a koan, it could be the breath, and so on. Though when you say just this, it means always returning to this instead of being involved in all those other things. Now, we're talking here of firewood and ash, for example. No one would deny that firewood becomes ash, nor that ash cannot return to being firewood. But the interesting thing is to be able to take two things that seem to be, one seems to be a temporal fact, that is to say, it's involved in time, it changes in time. And the other is the allegation that it is outside of this time. It is just purely a thing in itself, that is quite beyond all of those temporal manifestations. So in an example that I gave to someone lately, you can take two apples. On the one hand, and I'm doing my hands particularly this way, because you hold these two things together in your mind and make no attempt to resolve the problem. The unchanging apple is in some way identical with the rotting apple. Now watch the mind. The mind comes in, tries to make it an idea, working it out, idea of slicing time so fine that it doesn't exist, and all that kind of silliness. This is still the activity of the discursive mind. We're trying to help people to leap into a place of finding a mind that is not the discursive mind. And so we offer these paradoxes. Hold these two things together. Hold aging together with no aging. Just read this little poem by Uchiyama Roshi at this point. He says, though poor, never poor. Though sick, never sick. Though aging, never aging. Though dying, never dying. Reality prior to division. Herein lies unlimited depth. That little poem is given the fancy title of the Samadhi of the Treasury of the Radiant Light. But so it is a little hook also, because the mind will, it wants radiant light and a treasury, of course. So it's just, you realize this is all silliness. But the things presented, what is it that can be poor but not poor? At the same time, not alternatively. Not saying, well, it's poor with respect to, but not poor with respect to, That's still the discursive mind. It's trying to understand. And what you're understanding is out here. It's not in your being. We're talking about what is in your being. So these words are pointers. They are pointers at something, at a way of being with respect to these seeming paradoxes. Zen is not concerned with Aristotelian logic, which says that if it's A, it can't be not A. That's what the discursive mind is concerned about. It is in the realm of A and not A, exist totally simultaneously, and in fact, ultimately, are the same thing. And it's not something to be understood solely, although understanding can be a preface to actually doing the practice, but it is to be understood quite differently. And therefore we require in Zen, when people are engaged in the actual training of Zen, that whatever insight they get that might be a resolution of this seeming paradox, be it through a koan or some other means, it has to be demonstrated by the whole being. It cannot be a matter of words, a matter of simply explaining something. These are cheap and they're easy and they're not anything that Zen is concerned about. Zen is concerned about that it is about your whole being. It is to be expressed existentially, experientially, this understanding, this knowing. So I like to draw the distinction between understanding and knowing. Understanding requires placing things into some kind of a matrix where things hang together and everything has its place. Knowing is a directness of knowing. Like drinking water versus being knowledgeable in all the physics and chemistry of this substance, dihydrogen oxide. It's actually drinking water, knowing it from the viewpoint of experience. Now, that is what Uchiyama Roshi is pointing to in this little poem. Who is it that is poor, but never poor? What is it to be sick, but not sick, at the same time, not alternatively, not with respect to a different set of criteria, but at the same time, identically? What can that be? Aging and not aging. Dying and not dying. How is it that they can be known experientially as being exactly the same? Though in our discursive mind, we make those distinctions. A person can't be dying and not dying at the same time. It can't be aging and not aging, or sick and not sick at the same time. Unless we twist our smart discursive minds a little bit and say, well, it's only the cardiovascular system that's sick, but not the gastrointestinal system. So therefore, they're sick and not sick at the same time. And it's just a cutesy silliness. We're not talking about that. Anybody can do that. It's cheap. This is not knowing. We are concerned with knowing, not mere understanding. So, as he says here, we do not say that life becomes death, nor do we not say that death becomes life. What is this? What is this? For example, what is death? What is life? Did your life begin when you were born? Is that when life begins? Does life begin for an oak tree when it emerges from an acorn? Does life begin for a human being when that human being emerges from the birth canal, or earlier on, if you wish to, the fertilization of an egg or something? Is that when it begins? Or is this just a matter of silliness? the matter of things that can never be satisfactorily answered. They're all in the realm of this black and white. What is your experience? What is the experience that can teach you something? For all the other things can have the rug easily pulled out from underneath them. What is it experientially? And to demand of oneself to know this and express it experientially. This is something quite different. It is unique in the domain of Zen training. That is emphasized, that the discursive mind, what we call dead words, are considered to be of no value whatsoever. We demand, if words are used, that they be living words, that they be coming from the experience and the life of the individual. What can that be? So that is something to be remembered, the actual practice of Zen. The actual practice of Zen produces many benefits without that kind of, without a leap into that special kind of orienting to the world. There is a peacefulness that is produced. There is a physiological effect on the various organ systems in the body by performing the quieting meditation of letting go of thoughts and the mind and so on. We are talking about another level of this process, which is the level to which the first that I just mentioned is a preface, a useful preface and so on, and a preface that can offer, that can confer many benefits. But it is nonetheless from the viewpoint of the possibilities of coming into the life that is offered by the Zen process, a preface. And this is what we are talking about. And it requires a different kind of allegiance, an allegiance to knowing, an allegiance to dismissing anything that the discursive mind can offer you as a solution to these seeming paradoxes of poor and not poor, aging and not aging, sick and not sick, and so on. Firewood and ash. What does firewood and ash, we put these together, how are they identical? And we can do silly discursive mind things, can we not? Put a bit of chemistry in there and talk about the atoms that constitute both of them and so on and so on. And that's just an intellectual exercise. It may be useful in some context, but not here. It does not confer life. How are these things answered from a place that contains all the other things? This is the challenge of Zen. And it is only because we are so enamored and accustomed to utilizing our mind in this discursive way, taking as a commonsensical given that before exists and after exists, that actually past and present and future they actually have existence. There's actually something real about them. Dogen speaks of firewood and ash as an example, as an attempt to get one to put things that seem to be commonsensically obvious into a relationship where they are identical, and to stretch beyond the invitations of the discursive mind into a place where you can know directly, and then express this as the demonstration of your knowing it directly from your whole being. This is the direction of the practice of Zen. There is a koan in the Mumonkan It goes something like this: Daitsu Chisho Buddha did meditation in the meditation hall for 10 kalpas, maybe 100 kalpas, I don't know, but a very long time. The kalpa is the time required for the coming into being, the flourishing, and the death of a universe. So it's kind of a long time. So he did meditation in the meditation hall for 10 kalpas. And the question that is asked the monks is, why didn't he realize Buddhahood? If he did that much meditation, why didn't he realize Buddhahood? The fact is, all of us, teaching of the Buddha, we are already Buddha. We are already full and complete. But this fullness and completeness is masked by all our ideas of ourselves as existent along a temporal sequence, and gaining and losing and becoming. And that may be useful in some contexts, but within the context of Zen, which is an avenue to experiential, vibrant life, those considerations are all irrelevant. What does it mean? You are already full and complete. What about the tadpole? Full and complete, swimming about there in the pond. What about the caterpillar, full and complete? What about the resident in the chrysalis and the butterfly that emerges? We can say the caterpillar goes to a chrysalis, goes to a butterfly. That's not wrong. But it doesn't serve as a metaphor for something much closer than that, that the caterpillar is full and complete as a caterpillar. The chrysalis, likewise, with its transformations, is full and complete, and likewise the butterfly. We can understand that. But understanding doesn't cut it. It's simple, it's cheap, anybody can do it. You can understand, here I'm a happy caterpillar, walking on a leaf in the summer day and eating, chewing up the leaf and having a great time, and I don't care about chrysalises and butterflies in the future and all that stuff. It's easy to do. And nice, you could write children's stories about it. It's not what we're talking about. For we are pointing here. We are not delineating. We're not creating a metaphor for understanding. We're merely pointing that all these beings that we gratuitously place along a temporal sequence and give the significance of a caterpillar is the butterfly at the end. The significance of a tadpole is a frog, and so on. The significance of a human being is to have lived, quotes, a good life and accomplished this and that, and whatever it may be that your criteria are for a good life, whatever you'd like on your epitaph. It's not that. To something quite different at each moment, at each moment, at each moment. What is it to enter into that which is the case at each moment, the life-giving fact of each moment? What is that? That is the endeavor of Zen. So with gratitude to Dogen and Uchiyama Roshi, we'll end there tonight.